Whether she's telling the story of firing off a homemade cannon with her dad, explaining her obsession with The Godfather, or retracing the steps of the Trail of Tears, Sarah Vowell has been entertaining and enlightening public radio listeners for years. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Sarah Vowell is also expert at taking her readers on bizarre and fascinating journeys through history. Her next project will take readers to Hawaii in 1898, the year it was annexed by the United States. I'll talk with her, and you're welcome to join that conversation. Then later on, Carl Klaus will be here. He's the founding director of the University of Iowa's nonfiction writing program. He'll talk with us about his new book, The Made-Up Self, Impersonation in the Personal Essay. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Public radio listeners first fell for Sarah Vowell, her unique voice and fascinating stories on This American Life 14 years ago. She's also the author of 5 nonfiction books. Her most recent, The Wordy Shipmates, revisits Americans' Puritan roots. And her next book, due out in March, explores the Americanization of Hawaii. On Monday, November 1st, she'll be reading and speaking in Des Moines as part of Iowa Public Radio's Insight series. You can find more information about that on our website, iowapublicradio.org. And she's with us right now. Hello, Sarah.
Hey.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Sure thing.
Your very first book, Radio On, was a diary of a year spent listening to the radio. It was that book that caught the attention of Ira Glass and led to your first appearances on This American Life. Back then, what did you think you were going to be?
Well, when I was writing that book, I was in graduate school at the Art Institute of Chicago studying art history, and there were a lot of different directions I could have gone in. I was teaching freshman art history. I was researching my own dissertation. I thought I could perhaps be an art history professor or a museum curator. I was writing for weekly newspapers like the City Paper in or City Pages in Minneapolis and the Chicago Reader, and I was working on that book, and I was always kind of a dabbler, and I had started writing about music, and so I thought I didn't know exactly how I was going to make a living, but I knew I was going to be some kind of writer, at least part-time, and I honestly was so busy when I was writing that I didn't really have time to think about such things. I've never been much of a planner. I certainly didn't expect to work in radio after writing that book. It was more, I was writing a lot of criticism at the time.
Yeah, you didn't say very many nice things about radio.
Well, it was kind of a prison sentence having to listen to the radio all day, every day, and it was kind of a, It was a pretty grim time in the country in terms of talk radio. Certainly, it was, you know, it was the sort of right after the rise of Rush Limbaugh and his fellows, and it was before Littleton, and so there was a lot of just violent talk, and it was the time of the Patriot Movement, and I mean, I had some formal complaints about, you know, some of the radio and certainly the music radio, but the conservative talk radio was probably the most alarming, you know. Just there was just so much talk about shooting people. So that aspect of it was kind of debilitating and depressing, I guess.
When,
I think after Littleton happened, maybe the talk and Oklahoma City, that happened while I was listening that year. Some of the, you know, more extreme calls for violence sort of damped down.
When you did first start appearing on This American Life and started getting attention for that and started being in demand as a writer and an essayist, was there a point in time where it occurred to you, I get to do this full time, this is my job?
Yeah, well, I mean, when I finished school and I decided, okay, I'm going to do this, I mean, I was, I don't, you may not have noticed this, but public radio probably isn't the most lucrative way to make a living.
Oh, I haven't noticed that at all, no.
As a freelancer, so I was, I mean, it was painfully clear to me just because when I first started trying to make a living as a writer, I had to write so much and for so many different places just to pay the rent, you know. So I was, I was very proud of that, and it was certainly a great experience as a writer because I just had to write so much every day. And, you know, the radio pieces were just a part of that. I was writing a column for an online magazine. I was writing for weekly papers. I was writing for music magazines, and it was just a really heady time for me, and I never really had time to analyze what was happening to me just because I had so much to do. And, you know, when I speak to young writers, I always recommend that because I just racked up so much experience so fast just by the pure volume of having to make a living.
With your personal essays, you were on This American Life a lot. You were writing a lot of personal essays, telling a lot of wonderful stories about you and your family and your sister, your father. Did you ever feel, and of course your books also feature a lot of these essays and a lot of these stories, did you ever feel like you were mining too deeply into your personal life?
I mean, not really when I first started doing it. I mean, as you know, radio is sort of abstract in terms of the audience because our show was pre-recorded, and so I just was telling those stories to a stick in a room, you know. And really, I had no concept that people would listen to them and know things about me and my relatives. And so I was completely unhampered by those thoughts because, you know, it just never occurred to me that anyone would hear them. At the time, This American Life was so small. We were only on a few stations anyway, so it was there was a lot of freedom in that, you know, and especially now I travel a lot and I do a lot of readings. I meet the people who, you know, listen to the stories and read the books. And so now I have faces in my head. So I know, you know, I think I have become a little more buttoned up but there was a kind of just youthful ignorance about all that probably helped the stories, you know.
How did your family respond when they realized that so many people were hearing these stories about them?
I don't know. I mean, we don't really talk about it, we don't really talk about my job. I mean, they always just say, "Oh, I heard your story and I liked it," but it's never really been discussed. And you know, I mean, except that I did that one story that probably most public radio listeners have heard about, my father's cannon, where he made his own cannon, and
right.
I went with him and shot it off. And after that, he just assumed I was interested in what he's interested in now. So I have to hear about his projects more now because he thinks because I made that documentary, you know, I care about his blacksmithing projects, but that was kind of a one-time deal. So it was a kind of a turning point for us because I had never been interested in his projects before. But I don't know, with my family, I'm just kind of their kid. They don't really dig too deeply into my career.
So your dad's not striving to create something that will get you that interested again?
Not really, no.
In your books, after you sort of hit the big time and everybody was paying attention, take The Cannoli and Partly Cloudy Patriot are personal essays, and they tell a lot of these personal stories. And in Assassination Vacation, you gave us a lot more history, but still a lot of you. And in The Wordy Shipmates, it was less about you and more about the Puritans. Is that a choice that you made?
Probably. It's more of a direction, I think. I mean, probably as I get older and you know, I've been writing longer, I just kind of get to the point more, and I just fall in love with the subject matter a lot more. And when I first started out, I mean, there was definitely a transition because I kind of happened into the historical storytelling, but I'm sort of more happy now just finding things out, you know, just discovering the stories of the people I'm writing about. So I suppose the books have become less personal in that way, but I think they're personal to me in that my enthusiasm for the topic has, the topics I write about has kind of taken over, you know. And like writing about the Puritans, which I found is a topic people aren't necessarily excited about right off the bat, you know. The thing I can try and convey is my enthusiasm for that topic, and so I guess I've just become way more interested in my subject matter and way less interested in myself.
How do you decide your next project is about the Americanization of Hawaii? How do you pick the topics that you're going to delve into and write about?
Well, it's pretty, it's just kind of a feeling, you know. I mean, I get an idea and I look into it I don't know, I just kind of follow it. I don't always follow through. You know, I've thought of ideas and you know, worked on them a few months and then quit. But I just kind of get seized with something and want to know more. And it's kind of the luxury of the kind of writing I do because I'm not an historian with a capital H. And so it's like a real discovery process for me. And so basically if I just can't stop thinking about something and I just want to know more and I see the point of it, like with that story of 19th century Hawaii and leading up to 1898, I think it probably my enthusiasm for it has been reinforced by just the news of the last few years because 1898 to me is that's the year, it's really the summer that America becomes a world power, and just the last few years America's role as a world power has been kind of on my mind, and there are consequences of some of the decisions that were made in that year, you know, like these ideas of becoming a militaristic country and you know, taking possession of islands overseas and inserting ourselves into the world and our power and grooming that power and our military. And so though the specific story of Hawaii fascinated me, the kind of implications of that whole time period we're still sort of living with. And I don't know. I just kind of one thing leads to another.
Well, we'll talk more about Hawaii and your next project in a moment. My guest right now is Sarah Vowell, and she will be appearing in Des Moines on Monday night, November 1st, at Hoyt Sherman Place at 7 o'clock. And you can find out more about that event on our webpage, iowapublicradio.org, or on our Facebook page as well. You're welcome to join our conversations if you have questions for Sarah Vowell, 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up in a little while, we're going to talk about impersonation in the personal essay, the made-up self. That's in a few minutes. But right now, my guest is Sarah Vowell, who has written a number of personal essays herself, as well as 5 nonfiction books. Her next book is going to be about the Americanization of Hawaii. She's also going to be appearing in Des Moines on Monday night at 7 p.m. at Hoyt Sherman Place. And Sarah, you have written a lot about history. You are obviously fascinated with history. How do you feel about the fact that the general public in the United States doesn't seem to share your fascination or your passion with history?
I just completely ignored that. I don't think it's entirely true. I mean, I guess that's true of the wider population. But, you know, I write books for a living, and so you know, that's a smaller segment of the population, clearly, and my audience seems interested enough, or at least they're interested enough for me to keep being able to do it. And I actually think, the first piece I wrote about American history really was on This American Life, and it was this documentary I made on the Cherokee Trail of Tears, and the letters I got from that one first piece really kind of influenced my later path, because, you know, a lot of the letters were just, I didn't know about this, and I'm glad I do now. And it seemed like there was encouraging that there was just this kind of desire for pure knowledge. And I think because I didn't have a background as an historian, and because so much historical writing is so dense and kind of unedited in its, you know, depth, there was something for me just as a plain old-fashioned storyteller that I could get in and tell these stories in a way that was hopefully not alienating, though, that could include the reader or the listener, and that we could learn these things together, because I do find there is this desire to learn more, and so for me it's worked out fine. So I don't know.
It seems like your life has two very different sides of it now, as you delve deeper into sometimes a little bit obscure episodes in the history of the United States, or maybe forgotten, not necessarily obscure. But, and on the other side, you were the voice of Violet in The Incredibles. You've done some guest spots, like on Bored to Death on HBO. You're in briefly in the new movie Please Give. You're on The Daily Show. You're on Letterman. And so you have this side where you're researching dusty, musty history, and this other side where you're a celebrity. How does that work in your mind and in your life?
I mean, I don't really think these things through too much. A lot of that stuff, like, you know, being on Bored to Death or Please Give, those are just, you know, I was friends with that director of that movie, and Jonathan Ames, the writer who writes Bored to Death, is a buddy of mine, and, like, you know, those are just little, like, fun days out for me. I mean, I write books in my apartment for months at a time, and sometimes it's nice to, you know, leave the house and be around people, and, you know, writing books doesn't really allow for that much collaboration, so a lot of that stuff is just really a lark, and, like, for me, they're just acts of friendship, really. And, you know, when you're sitting in your apartment for months on end researching the Puritans, it's nice, like on Bored to Death, I got to spend a morning hanging out with Ted Danson, like, you know, just chatting, and that was fun, but it's not my real life. But I guess I approach everything the same way, even if they're in different media, or if they have different aims, or some things are just jokey and other things more serious. I'm still, I'm always myself, and I try and, you know, do my best, whatever I'm doing, so I don't really think about it too much, but it's kind of sort of more like what living in New York is like, you know, like some, you know, like tomorrow I'm going to see Jackass in 3D, and last night I was at some information meeting on conservation in the West, you know, so life is very varied here, and I'm sure in Iowa too, and so I don't really draw a bunch of lines. It's just whatever interests me, I do it, and I try, and I'm always kind of the same, I think, you know.
Peter is on the line from Moline, Illinois. Hello, Peter.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I was just riveted the first time I heard Amy on This American Life, and she did a piece on the Battle Hymn of the Republic. And it was just remarkable. And that was a song that I grew up with in church. And now I can embarrassingly say I actually thought she was David Sedaris' sister.
You're talking to Sarah Vowell.
Yes.
Not Amy Sedaris.
Right.
Well, that's a good sort of example of, like, what I like to do with American history. That story was about sort of the behind the music of the Battle Hymn of the Republic, and I think I had that idea after September 11th, because that song, they were singing it at the memorial service at the National Cathedral, and, you know, it's we'd just gone through this act of terrorism, and that song, that's the song we sing at funerals and in war, and that when we were singing that in the National Cathedral service, it struck me that, you know, the melody of that song derives from an older song about John Brown, the abolitionist John Brown, which is, he was, you know, an American terrorist. And so it was just that little, like, light bulb where I wanted to learn more about both songs, about the battle hymn and about John Brown. And we were going out on tour, This American Life on a Live Tour, and we had a band with us. So it was such a great opportunity to tell the story of those songs with a band who could do musical illustrations.
Well, Peter, thank you so much for your call. And Sarah, we have just a moment left. You have done so many different things in your career, and you've met with so much success. Is there something that's still out there that you think, if I could only do that?
No, I mean, I write books for a living, and that seems to be an endangered job. So I guess my dream is to be able to keep doing that. I hope people keep reading books and that books still exist in the future. I also dabble writing for newspapers. I would like that to continue. So I don't think there's any one thing that I think, oh, if I could only do that. It's more like, golly, I really hope that I can continue to do the things that I love to do.
Well, Sarah, thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, well, thank you.
Sarah Vowell is well known to many public radio listeners from all of her appearances on This American Life. She's also the author of 5 nonfiction books. Her most recent, The Wordy Shipmates, was about America's Puritan roots. Her next book, due out in March, explores the Americanization of Hawaii. And she is going to be appearing in Des Moines on Monday night, November 1st at 7 p.m. as part of Iowa Public Radio's Insight series. That's at Hoyt Sherman Place. You can find out more about that event on our website, iowapublicradio.org. You can also look at the events part of our Facebook page if you search for Iowa Public Radio on Facebook. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Carl Klaus is the founding director of the University of Iowa's nonfiction writing program. For many years, he's taught classes based on personal essays. He's written many personal essays himself. And in his latest book, he writes about this unique art form. The book is The Made-Up Self, Impersonation in the Personal Essay. And Carl, the personal essay is everywhere today. We were just talking about Sarah Vowell, who made her the start of her career writing personal essays that were aired on the radio. You hear a lot of personal stories on the radio. You read them all over the place. Memoir books are a dime a dozen these days.
But that's really a recent phenomenon. It's something that transpired essentially over the past 25 years or so. Of course, the personal essay goes all the way back to Montaigne.
Well, let's go back in history to what the personal essay was when it first started appearing.
Well, it was in a way the invention of Montaigne, who decided to write of himself at the end of the 16th century in France. And at that time, that was a completely radical gesture. The thought of writing of oneself was unheard of. At the beginning of the 16th century, when Bacon started writing, he was deliberately impersonal, no references to himself whatsoever. And for many years, really, the personal essay languished, except for the publication and republication, translation and retranslation of Montaigne.
Was it considered to be an arrogant act to write of oneself at that point?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And he writes at length in his essays about how radical and daring and unconventional this is. I am myself the subject of his work, he said. And that was like throwing down a glove, putting a stake in the ground and marking it. And really, until the beginning of the 19th century in England, with essayists like Hazlitt and Lamb, and the general self-consciousness that we associate with Romanticism, the personal essay really languished. In fact, was a radical gesture for E.B. White in mid-20th century to decide that he was going to write essays in the first-person singular because as a writer for The New Yorker, he had been using the plural first-person we. And he retreated to his farm in Maine and started to write the essays that turned into One Man's Meat and made him famous. But even then, at the height of his popularity, in 1983, when he published the collected essays, he acknowledged that the essay still stands somewhere down the line.
You spend some time in your book trying to define what the personal essay is and talking about how other people have defined it. Like Scott Russell Sanders said, it's the closest thing, pardon me, it's the closest thing we have on paper to a record of the individual mind at work and play. But thoughts don't fall out onto the paper. What are we seeing or what are we reading when we read a personal essay?
Well, when you get a personal essay, you're getting two stories simultaneously. You're getting the story of experience, what people remember of what happened to them at a particular moment in time, but you're also getting what I think of as the story of thought. And it's the interplay of those two stories, the story of experience and the story of thought, or what you might call the outer story and the inner story, that make for the power of the personal essay. But of course, that inner story, the story of thought, which is where the real power resides, is a fiction, a construction, because in fact, we can't keep up with the flow of thoughts in our mind. If we gave a transcription of what's running through our mind at any particular moment, it would be a jumble. So what personal essayists do is to create or try to create something like the illusion of a mind in action, a mental sally, as Montaigne would have called it.
You write quite a bit about E.B. White's essays, and you write about, in particular, one of his essays, Collage, which you had only seen a portion of for many years. You hadn't seen all of the pieces together, but that is one of those pieces that he wrote to try to show how his mind was working.
Oh, you mean the essay called Spring. Spring 1941, yes.
And tell us, because a lot of us haven't read E.B. White's essays, tell us what he was trying to do with that.
Well, that's an unusual essay, but what he was trying to do was in fact to create that sense of the flow of thought in his mind. As he was thinking about Spring in 1941, and he gives essentially just notations of what's happening around the farm, but notations about what is happening around the farm are mixed in with memories of conversations in New York, and letters from a librarian scolding him for his behavior, and it reads a bit like a jumble, unless you take note of the first line of the essay, which says, "Thoughts on spring and anything else that comes to mind of an intoxicating nature," he said. And so it's that, it's the sense of intoxication, in a way, and the excitement of spring that holds that piece together. But it's an emblem of all of the stuff that's going through his mind at that moment. It's the track of a month's experience, because each of those pieces that White wrote was published in Harper's Monthly.
My guest right now is Carl Klaus. He is the founding director of the University of Iowa's nonfiction writing program. And today we're talking about the personal essay. We're talking about how people who write personal essays present themselves, how they invent themselves. Carl Klaus's book, latest book, is called The Made-Up Self, Impersonation in the Personal Essay. And we will talk more about the evolution of the personal essay and how people present themselves in essays and memoir in a moment. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. And right now, my guest is Carl Klaus. He is the founding director of the University of Iowa's nonfiction writing program, the author of many books, and his most recent is The Made-Up Self, Impersonation in the Personal Essay. And that's what we're talking about today. We're talking about the evolution of the personal essay, which is so very popular today. And we're also talking about the identity of the writer and how that is crafted in the personal essay. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can also tweet us at IPR Talk, or you can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. When we read a personal essay, it usually begins with I, or it falls in there somewhere. How do we know who that person is, the writer?
We don't, in fact, have any way of knowing who it is. I think that we automatically assume, because what we're hearing is so conversational and comes across in such a natural style, that's what's typical of the personal essay, that we automatically identify it with the name of the person who wrote it. And the identification of the author with the text is almost inescapable because of the significance of I. That's entrenched. It makes an equation. But there's always some sense in which that self is made up, if only because it's not made of flesh and blood. It's not a live utterance like the utterance you're hearing at this very moment. It's made out of words, and so it is perforce a kind of fiction, a construction. Or as Scott Russell Sanders says, what we meet on the page is not the flesh and blood author, but a character who wears the label I. Or as E.B. White once said, writing is by definition a form of imposture. I'm not at all sure I am anything like the person I seem to a reader. And once when I was looking at the drafts of one of E.B. White's essays, I've written about this in the book, I remember being shocked by what I read because the writing was so clumsy. It had none of the wit, the deftness, the verbal play that one associates with White. But then as I looked at the several drafts of that piece, I could see that progressively what he did was to take out all of that intense feeling that was in his notations and also the intense clumsiness and create what we think of as the voice of E.B. White. So to come back to your question, what are we getting? We're getting the author's construction of himself for that particular occasion. And the voice may change, the self may change from essay to essay to essay. Here's White again. The essayist can pull on any sort of shirt, be any sort of person, according to his mood or his subject matter. Philosopher, scold, jester, raconteur, confidant, devil's advocate, enthusiast.
Well, Virginia Woolf also had some thoughts on that. She said that the real challenge of the personal essay was to never be yourself and yet always.
Yes, yes. And Vivian Gornick, who's writing in America Today, came up with a formulation that was almost identical to Woolf's, finding a self that was me and that was not me. And I think that's what's involved in the kind of performance that takes place in the writing of a personal essay, crafting a self that meets the needs of one's convictions and feelings at that particular moment, which is an impersonation of a kind, but also being true to yourself.
You know, I think that we all do that in life, though, not just in this particular art form, but I think about radio, and we certainly do that in radio. When I come to the table at 10 o'clock in the morning for Talk of Iowa, I'm a more informed person than I am at, let's say, 8 a.m.
Exactly so. Exactly so. And that may well be what's at the root of the personal essay's success, that in a way what it does is to represent what we all do all the time. We're shape-shifting, and it's not just that there are two of us or three of us. There are five or six or seven of us. There are many of us contained with any one of us. And so, yes, it's not as if this is deceitful or a deviation from the norm. It's commonplace. But I think that for many, many years, readers took it for granted that there was some kind of one-for-one literal correspondence. Or as we used to say when I was in college, style is the man. And then at the beginning of an essay, I said, it's also the woman. But the point is, it's the person. And in fact, style is more than just the person.
In the evolution of the personal essay, it's interesting to note that almost every single person that we have talked about so far has been a middle or upper class white man who wrote the personal essay. We've mentioned two women so far, but that was a big part of the evolution of the personal essay when it stopped just being the property or the arena of the well-off white male.
That's true. That's true. I have a specific chapter here devoted to that issue in the book, and it's called Difference in I, Cultural Consciousness in the Personal Essay, and it deals with writers such as James Baldwin, Alice Walker, and a number of Chicana and Chicano writers, yes, but they really significantly altered the whole character of the personal essay, because prior to that time, it had been, I think, an essentially apolitical form, and it had been a form that was more or less privileging the kind of wry, witty persona that we associate with E.B. White or with Charles Lamb, or for that matter, with Virginia Woolf herself.
We have a caller on the line right now, Ron in Riverdale, called 866-780-9100. You're also welcome to join our conversation. Hello, Ron.
Hello, good morning.
Hi, what would you like to talk about?
Well, the more I hear about the personal essay and expansions on it, the more I gain the feeling that perhaps Cervantes and his subject, Don Quixote, was nothing more than an enormous expansion of personal essay.
I think that's an immensely witty a connection, a brilliant link, and I think it is true that there are many works of literature that if we think about their form and the way they're delivered to us are in a sense essayistic. And there is a good deal of discussion among critics and scholars and theorists of the essay about essayism or what it means to be essayistic. And so I would certainly agree with you.
Well, Ron, thank you so much for your call.
Thank you.
It seems to me that there is a very fine line between the nonfiction personal essay and fiction. You write about a number of essayists who invented a persona, had a pseudonym, and wrote these personal essays, these apparently nonfiction personal essays under a pseudonym, and that does seem like that crosses the line into fiction.
Well, I think that the fundamental distinction that I would keep in mind is that in a personal essay, there's a tacit contract between the writer and the reader that what is being asserted as having happened. Now, maybe not in every specific detail, but that the story of experience, that outer story to which I was referring earlier, has an actuality in experience. It's not an invention. It's not a construction. It's the mediating self that is the construction in the personal essay. And so although the voice is made out of language and constructed and in some sense fictionalized, the experience isn't. That's the difference, I think. And so although I've written a playful piece that will be appearing in the Chronicle Review about the put-ons of personal essayists and wondering why Oprah didn't send her truth squad after them, ultimately I believe that personal essayists are in fact true to their experience and true to their sense of themselves at the moment of crafting the piece itself.
In writing about the evolution of the personal essay, you have another wonderful quote from Virginia Woolf that I didn't write down, so I can't tell you exactly what she said. But it was talking about when personal essays began to shift from being simply opinion pieces to being something more personal. She said something about people writing about a picture that only they could see or music that only they could hear, their own something that came from deep within.
Yes, I think that this is in a piece written very early in her career, in fact, and she is urging people to write, in fact, about that one thing that only they know, and that is what they see in the mirror, the image of themselves. That is the subject about which they have the greatest authority. Now, that was a really striking comment for her to be making at that point in her life. because she was in a way so traditional in her outlook in those early years. And there's a sense in which she became uncomfortable with that kind of what she calls egoistic writing. So I think that Woolf herself was really torn in her feelings about the involvement of the self. And that's why I think that remark that she makes, never to be yourself and yet always, is a kind of balancing act that's really true to her own ambivalence about implicating yourself in your work.
We talked about right at the beginning of our conversation that personal essay is everywhere now, and memoir is everywhere now, and this is a fairly recent development. But who do you read that's writing now that you really admire?
Well, there's a young man who's down at the University of Arizona whose essays I'm reading at this very moment, and his name is Ander Monson. And Monson's essays are very interesting to me because he's trying to do something that is attempting to stretch the boundaries of the essay, because what he has within the essay are little daggers following individual words. And those daggers point to words that you can then pursue by linking into his website, where he has further reflections on those words and the experiences to which they're linked. And I think what he's trying to do here is to extend that play of the mind on paper into the further play of the mind on a blog.
So really making your mind, the reader's mind, do the same machinations, go through the same hoops that his have.
Exactly so. And one of the interesting things about this is that it's actually historically linked to the very origins of the essay, because when Montaigne wrote his essays, he took them through three editions. And in each edition, he didn't change any words, he didn't drop any words, but he often added words or added whole passages because, as he said, he didn't want to lose any of his thoughts. And now Monson is trying to do the very same thing in an even more grand and technologically up way by sending you to the Internet.
Well, Carl Claus, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Carl Claus is the author most recently of The Made-Up Self, Impersonation in the Personal Essay. He was also the founding director of the University of Iowa's nonfiction writing program. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Lindsay Moon. You can listen to Talk of Iowa anytime. Podcasting and on-demand audio are available on our website, iowapublicradio.org. You can send us email anytime at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up Monday on Talk of Iowa, Reclaiming Your Holidays. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. We'll be right back.